We're on the UCSD campus at CalIT2, which I've just remembered is California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology, which we are surrounded by, and this is the Machine Perception Laboratory. And we're with Marion Stewart Bartlett, who's the co-director of it, and you're usually called Marnie, right?
That's right.
Okay. So I was just looking also at the number of projects that you have going here. Computer expression recognition toolbox, sensory motor facial expressions, computational analysis of nonverbal behavior and adaptive tutoring, we'll get to all of these. Automated detection of pain, driver drowsiness, little thing here on Homeland Security. But they all revolve around the notion of this beginnings I'm looking at now, which is essentially, this was your doctoral dissertation, that's which right. became a book, Face Image Analysis by Unsupervised Learning. Looking at facial expressions, recognizing facial expressions, why don't you just give me some sense of that whole background.
Sure. Actually, so the projects that you just described are projects that are all within the computational face group at the lab, which is a group that I lead. And I'm interested in learning and face processing, both from a biological perspective and from a computational perspective for computer vision, and also understanding computationally what's going on with face processing. So one tier of work has to do with face recognition in humans and using computational principles such as information theory to understand or have a new perspective on face processing in humans. Another tier, and the book is largely about that. Yeah. Another tier is recognition of facial identity. That was work that I did for my thesis work, and more recently, I focused on recognition of facial expressions, automatic recognition of facial expressions. So I developed computer vision approaches based on machine learning, and that was in collaboration with Terry Sanofsky and Javier Movillon and Gwen Littlewort, all members of TDLC. So we developed new machine learning approaches to get facial expression recognition by computer to work in real time and robustly be somewhat robust to variations in lighting conditions, which is a very difficult task for a computer vision system to do. And now that system is working and able to extract a signal from spontaneous behavior, we're now applying that system to measuring the face and learning new things about facial behavior, such as facial behavior when people are expressing pain, measuring how much pain they have from their face, and telling the difference between when people are having real pain versus faking pain. How do the face movements differ?
So how does the face movements differ if I feel your pain?
So right? That's right. So are you asking how
yes.
Yeah? Okay. So what the face movements differ primarily in the dynamics, and this is something that some other researchers have measured as well, using very slow, laborious, and painstaking manual coding approaches, and they're only able to get some very small discrete measures of the dynamics, and we're able to, because we run in real time, we can get much more information about the dynamics at 30 frames per second, 30 hertz. So one of the differences is that the spontaneous expressions tend to be more ballistic, so they come on quickly and come off quickly. The posed pain expressions tend to come on in a more ramped fashion, be
held
on.
You have to crank up your pain.
Yeah, and then they're held for too long. That's one of the main things that happens with the faked expressions. They're held for too long, and there's some issues about the regularity of the expressions. If we ask people to fake a pain expression for a period of 1 minute, and during that minute they do things like, both in real pain and fake pain, you open your mouth, but in faked pain, people open their mouths at more regular intervals, as if they're saying, oh yeah, I need to I need to open my mouth, and oh, I haven't done it in a while, better do it again. So those, so the mouth opening has got very regular intervals compared to the spontaneous pain expressions where the intervals are less regular.
So you could actually help drama coaches.
Perhaps.
So I don't want this to be a carnival show, but you can actually do lots of these facial expressions, right? I've seen you doing demos and so on, so you're very practiced at doing this. And this goes back to some extent, as I look in your book here, there's a picture here, and we're talking about the facial action coding system.
Yes.
And that is Paul Ekman,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is.
And I remember doing, when I did that PBS series called The Human Quest, doing a session with Paul and sitting there and looking at facial expressions and doing stuff and having him explain to me how he could spot fakes and how there's this very limited group of people could really spot, very quickly figure out who was faking expressions and so on. It's all very interesting. You worked with Paul in the early days?
I did, yeah. So when I first came onto this project, as a graduate student, I was a graduate student with Terry Sanosky.
Right.
And Paul and Terry had an NSF grant proposal for automating the facial action coding system. And the idea was to apply neural network approaches, i.e. machine learning style approaches, to this computer vision problem of recognizing facial expressions. At that time it was in images, not video, because
right.
nobody had enough storage space to store all of the video. Although they did get some sequences of frames so that they could gather some motion information from it as well. But that originated out of the collaboration with Terry Sanosky and Paul Ekman, and spearheaded largely by Beatrice Guillaume as well, the initial collaboration between the two and the grant proposal. Mm. And there was an NSF planning workshop as well in around 1992 or 3 for what is the best way, let's make a plan to go about how to automate facial expression measurement. And so this grant proposal emerged out of that effort. And I had the good fortune to be a graduate student at the time looking for a project that had to do with neural network learning and faces. So I started working on that with Terry, and the project was then, about when I graduated, the project was in fact picked up by, it was noticed by the CIA. So we were approached by a member of the CIA to do a feasibility analysis. They knew about Paul's work, about facial behavior and deception, that while there's no such thing as a red flag for deception, his work had shown for some time that there were facial signals that could guide or provide some information about truthfulness. And so they came to us to say, is there a way to measure this by computer? Is it feasible? Mm. Or what do we need to do? Would it be feasible in the next 10 years? So the program got our team, as well as a team from Carnegie Mellon, into what we all refer to as a co-opetition. So the team at Carnegie Mellon was led by Jeff Cohn and Takeo Kanade. And we looked at measurement of a distinct set of facial actions in video of spontaneous behavior, which at that time, nobody at that point had been able to get a reliable signal out of spontaneous facial expression, because the computer vision problem is just that hard. But the machine learning kinds of approaches provided some robustness for those kinds of contexts, and we were able to make some progress. And now, in 2010, we have a system that works in real time that can provide a reliable signal, not completely noise-free. It's got lots of noise. It's a little bit like EEG. But it does get a signal from spontaneous expressions in real time that we can now do something with.
Yeah, I don't expect you to tell me the details of this, but it is public on the website here,
sure.
And you're obviously doing stuff, and I know Paul is with Homeland Security as well. And you'd expect that, wouldn't you? I mean, if you're able to detect people coming through a screen and they're obviously reliably detecting, you were able to reliably detect that they were giving you bogus information, that would be useful information, wouldn't it?
It would be useful to everyone's security.
Have things improved since that initial foray with the CIA?
Sure. As I mentioned, the detection rates have gone up, but most importantly, we can work in real time, and extract a signal from spontaneous expression. So the performance, our detection performance, has gone way up. The speed at which we can do this has gone way up. And what I'm very excited about in the lab is that we can use this system to learn about the face and to do basic research about facial behavior, and to use it to do things such as provide information about students in adaptive tutoring. So it's useful in many different situations and lots of contexts.
Well, let's do that one. Computational analysis of nonverbal behavior in adaptive tutoring. That looks to me awfully like your son.
Yes.
So that's Paul right there.
That's Paul. I think he was about 9 years old. He's 10 now.
And what was what's the point of the project here? What's the rationale?
The point of the project is to understand children's nonverbal behavior during problem solving. So what does their face do? What does it look like when they're solving a problem? When they're at the beginning of a problem and it's confusing, and they're grappling with it,
puzzled
versus the aha moment when they get it. Ah. So we have some data where we look at some facial behaviors such as the zygomatic, which is associated with positive emotion, versus the corrugator region, which is associated with negative emotion. And we see that as they're given a puzzle to solve, we see the zygomatic signal going up and the corrugator signal going down. And if we look at the time course and the dynamics of these, it seems to actually be a rapid movement between different states. So we have a lot of different kinds of facial behaviors associated with brow furrowing, puzzling, concentration. The eyes are a little bit narrower. And then over about a half a second or a quarter of a second interval, they suddenly, there's a head movement, they turn to the experimenter, the zygomatic goes up, the corrugator relaxes, the eyes become wider, and they give the answer to the experimenter.
All right, now what does that tell you? I mean, how is that useful apart from being interesting to watch?
Well, one of the things that we really want to do is to build an adaptive tutoring system. So we want to be able to automatically measure the state of the student so that we can adapt the material accordingly. So we want to be, if the student is frustrated, we want to be able to detect that and then adapt the material or the teaching style based on the student's state. So, one of the ways we're going to measure the student state is with the automated tutoring system. So we want to be able to gather information from this sensor and go directly to changing the tutoring instruction. And we actually have a preliminary results from one of our students, Jake Whitehill, who showed that who built a prototype model of an adaptive tutoring system. Right. Now, this is just a very simple proof of principle, but what he did was he had students watching a video lecture and was measuring the face in real time as they were watching the lecture, and they were choosing the presentation speed. Some of the lectures were more easy or more difficult, and so they were pushing arrow keys to make the lecture faster or slower. And then afterwards, they went back and they did. They were replayed the lecture, and this time they pushed arrow keys to say, well, this part was easy and this part was hard. So the second time around, they measured difficulty. So the first time was viewing speed. The second time was a frame by frame difficulty measure. He found that he was able to predict the self reports of lecture difficulty from the real time measurements of the face. Similarly, with the preferred viewing speed, he was able to predict preferred viewing speed from the real-time measurements of the face. So this is just a proof of principle or a first-pass prototype showing that we can gather information in real time about states having to do with teaching and learning And that information could potentially be used to adapt the presentation of the material.
Now, would you, this is a computerized system, right? So are you talking about having, as it were, a personal robot doing the assay on the student to see whether they're learning or what's going on? Or is this an adjunct to a teacher, or how does this work
in a real-time situation? The idea is to make tutoring systems approach the benefit of one-to-one tutoring, because one-to-one tutoring has been known for a long time to be hugely effective for teaching students. And if we could have one-on-one tutoring for every student in the country all the time, we would do that. But that's not practical. It's not possible. So when we can't have one-to-one tutoring available, it would be very good to make automated tutors be more effective. So how do we make the automated tutoring system capture some of the things that a human tutor does? And one of the things that a human tutor does is a human tutor picks up on not only the performance information about what the student is doing, did the student get the last answer right or wrong, but also what's that student's behavior like. And particularly in younger kids, you get a lot of nonverbal behavior. You see there's frustration, there's joy, there's interest, there is lack of attention. There are lots of things. So what does the human tutor do? What kinds of signals do they pick up on regarding frustration? What do they do when the child is frustrated? What do they do with their bodies to re-engage and reorient the child towards the material? Mm-hmm. That has a big impact on the efficacy of the learning session. Just that engagement of attention and then moving the attention to the material at hand. So all of those things are the kinds of things that we want to be able to capture in. Some of those things could be captured in an automated tutoring system. Some of them would require more of a robotic system to actually engage and move the 3D spatial attention. But those are some of the things we're interested in.
So could you actually use these as well as part of a teacher's training? To get some sort of profile of what's going on during a...
Certainly one of the things that we're doing is we are studying student-tutor interactions with very experienced and effective teachers. Yeah. And we can learn from those teachers what they do, and that information could be extremely useful for teachers who are newer to the field, or perhaps teachers who haven't had as much success engaging students. I think we need to learn from the very best teachers. I think that's for the most part, that's the direction that the information needs to go, is to find the very best teachers, see what they do, learn about what they do, generalize somewhat, and then that information could then be transferred to other people who perhaps are less experienced.
Okay, now what you've got here is a sentence here which I find very helpful. The project will help advance the science of learning and teaching by improving our understanding of the dynamics of nonverbal behavior in teaching at a computational level across multiple time scales.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center in a nutshell. So you're basically saying timing is hugely important here, from micro expressions to verbal expressions, across the whole gamut.
Exactly.
And here's a way of doing an analysis of it and being able to utilize it to improve teaching and learning.
Exactly. So the comment there about the multiple timescales with respect to this particular project has to do with the fact that we are coding these student-teacher interactions at multiple levels. So at one level, we code teacher strategy. So we would say, student is frustrated, teacher change strategy in this way. At another level, we would actually code the nonverbal behavior of the student and the teacher at, again, the 30 frames per second or even faster timescales. Mm-hmm. So because we have the real-time video of the teacher's face and of the student's face. Is the teacher mirroring the student's facial behavior or not? Is the teacher mirroring the student's posture? What are they doing with their eye movements and their head mm-hmm. movements? And how are they coupled? So we have information about the interaction at multiple levels of coding. And that information it's going to be a database of information. It's not going to be one answer. It's going to be a whole probability distribution. That information is going to be what informs automated tutoring systems. And that information is what we intend to make available for automated tutoring systems.
Okay, now we talked about the automatic detection of pain. I think most people just imagine that if somebody's in pain and you observe somebody in pain, I suppose the folk psychology would be that you've got mirror neurons and that makes you sort of, some social mimicry. You feel their pain and so on. You've got more of a detailed story though than that, surely, right?
Absolutely. So we looked at subjects who were experiencing real pain and faked pain, as I described earlier.
Right.
And so the real pain was, that condition was created by having them insert their hand in a bucket of ice water. That's called cold presser pain. And then we asked those subjects to fake their pain and a moment later.
Right.
And so then we had observers looking at video of those subjects that were having real pain and fake pain. And we asked them to guess who was real and who was fake. So, and certainly when you see a face that, a pain facial expression, there is a tendency to mirror the expression. There's a tendency of people to mirror all facial expressions. That happens in most typically functioning people.
Or social postures and so on
as well. Yes, exactly. So, and it's a very unconscious kind of thing. So one of the things that we looked at in particular, and some students in several of our labs at the center looked at, was the degree to which this mirroring behavior might also tap into the ability to tell the difference between whether someone was telling the truth or having genuine pain, or whether someone was faking pain. And did the coupling of the facial expression somehow provide an indicator of how well that person could differentiate the truthful from the faked behavior?
So, I mean, I'm just thinking now of movies. I mean, and actors, as I mentioned earlier. I mean, we watch movies, and there's some pretty convincing moments when you think, oh my God, that person's really in pain.
Yes.
So, how are they managing to, or are we just lulled into that? Are we sort of? Is there some sort of technique that makes us? Is there something in the timing and the dynamics of what you're talking about that film directors have somehow intuited and have built into their acting instructions, directions to people? I mean, how do they manage to pull this stuff off so well?
Well, one thing that I do know about is method acting.
Yeah.
So one approach to acting is to actually place yourself mentally in the situation that you're attempting to portray. So if you want to portray somebody who is sad, you make yourself very sad. And in that way, you can actually tap into motor systems that are related to spontaneous facial expression production and spontaneous nonverbal behavior production, so that the muscles that move are the right ones, and the timing and the dynamics of those movements are the right ones. Because it turns out that we actually have two different motor pathways for facial expression production. There's one that originates in the primary motor strip, and that one seems to mediate voluntary facial movements or pose displays. But spontaneous expressions of emotion, in contrast, seem to originate from subcortical areas, and they have a different temporal profile, a different dynamics. Mm. So there are actually these two different motor systems at play at once in the face, this more cognitive movement and the more spontaneous movement with different dynamics of the two going on at once. So so in acting, you really want to tap into the spontaneous system. And I have to say that after experience working with facial expression and so on, I start to get very sensitive to movies where I do notice sometimes actors making the wrong facial movements for certain emotions. And I think I pick up on that a little bit more quickly. A common one is that sometimes actors, when they want to act upset or distressed about something, they'll do that. And that's actually the wrong direction. They need to raise those brows up. So
actually, you've got this paper here, which called Learning to Make Facial Expressions.
Oh, that's by one of the students in the lab, yes.
Ting-Fang Wu.
Yes.
Nick Butko as well. Paul Rivelot is on here as well.
And Javier.
Yes. Right. So it's almost a funny title in a sense, isn't it? Because you it's not something you'd think you'd need to learn. But have you become acutely aware, obviously, of how these things are made?
How facial expressions are made?
And has that changed the way you interact with people, how you view people, how you comport yourself, how you change your own facial? I mean, you see what I'm getting at.
I do see what you're getting at. I think for the most part, it is very hard to be cognitively aware of someone's facial expression at the same time that you're conversing with them. So on the one hand, I'm aware of these, and if I've got stop motion video or a video playback, I can look at things and understand better what's going on or think about what's going on. But for the most part, in live interaction, I simply have to listen to the message that's going on. And sometimes the verbal interaction simply takes over, and it's very difficult to be sensitive to the facial expression at the same time. I tried to do that when I was a juror. I tried to watch the facial behavior, but it was hard to do both.
Really? So I mean, did you, when you started all this off, when you were interacting with Paul, I mean, how extensive, did you sort of go through facial expression boot camp or something, I mean, as it were?
I did,
like mixed metaphors,
yes.
Well,
actually, a former student of Paul Ekman's runs a facial expression boot camp, and So I did get training in the facial action coding system, and I learned how to detect the different facial movements visually myself, and I got more information about what emotions each of them tends to be associated with.
So there was a series on Fox called Lie to Me.
Yes.
And the star was obviously modeled on Paul Ekman, somebody called Cal Lightman, but he was brilliantly played by this British actor called Tim Roth.
Yes.
At least I thought it was great.
Yes. And he actually has pictures in his virtual office hanging up on the wall that are modeled after that picture that you just showed of Paul Ekman.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So do you think that was a reasonable? Do you think that's something that people will reasonably do? I mean, there's also this company called Lie to Me fMRI called fMRI Lie fMRI. There are companies out there now which are saying, look, I mean, if you're having people trying to do truth detection and so
right.
on, at some point fMRIs will get their brain states and so on.
The Lie to Me program is a very exaggerated and Hollywoodized version of the facial behavior literature, but actually Paul Ekman is a consultant on the Lie to Me program, and so the science that they mention in that program is accurate science. So those results, when they say, well, this facial movement is associated with this and that facial movement means that, that information is coming, it is coming straight from Paul, because I know the studies that they come from. So I've really enjoyed that tremendously, because everything that they say is either based on science that I know about, and every time I hear something that I didn't know, I assume it's probably true and came from Paul. I don't know. I hope so. But it's very useful in that respect. But of course, the ability to make a snap judgment on a single person is completely exaggerated and fictitious. But the fact that there is information in there, and if you brought in 20 people, you know, you might be able to tell with 70% accuracy, you know, that they're this versus that. So there is some information in there. This information about whether somebody might have suicidal depression or not, or information about whether a couple in marriage counseling might stay together or get divorced. There's information in the face that's predictive about that.
Yeah. I guess back to my earlier point, I mean, do you think that people could learn how to read? Implicit in this is that earlier question about actors. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about your students and the hand in the cold and then mm-hmm. trying to figure out whether it was a fake pain expression or not, and I was saying actors do this really so yes. well, but it's trained sure. as well. So could you have trained your students to have done a better job of faking pain? Do you think, are these trainable things?
I think that with feedback, with the right feedback, a lot of things are trainable. I think that the perception component is certainly trainable. You can learn to recognize facial expressions better with training. You can learn to recognize them faster, and you can learn to recognize very, very brief displays. Mm. And one of the questions that we're interested in the lab is whether facial expression production is trainable. And I think it may be, but I think it needs to be the right kind of feedback. You need to be able to, in a sense, look in a mirror and have, or look at the computer and have the computer give you immediate feedback of closer, 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 yes.
Yeah. I was going to say whether it would be a better world if people were better at reading other people's facial expressions.
Now, I think it would be.
Well, I don't know. I once asked Paul about this, and I said, well, what if you could tell 100% if somebody was lying? He said, oh, it'd be terrible. Be terrible. You'd never get away with little white lies.
Yes.
If your wife said to you, does this dress look good on me?
Although here's something that's very useful.
You have to be able to lie socially.
You do, but wouldn't the world be a better place if everyone was much more sensitive to the subtle cues of annoyance?
Oh yeah.
Then there's this little cue that the chin, yeah, exactly. The lips tighten just a little bit. And it's a minor thing. People usually don't even realize that they're doing it when they do. Yeah. And they may never say a word because they don't want to be rude. But if you can pick up on those things, and if everyone picked up on those things and realized that, oh, you know, I'm crossing a boundary here, I need to back off, then I do think the world would be a much better place.
So what would you do at that point? You say, I said something wrong? Am I bothering you? What would you do? Would you be
maybe you would do that, but I think that could be annoying too. but you think back, well, what did I do? And then think, okay, well, I either need to stop doing that, or I should just leave and go do something else right now. Yeah. Should just back off. So I do think that's useful.
Driver drowsiness. Next on your a la carte menu here of problems to be solved or dealt with. So how does the facial action coding system and all these things come to play in the driver drowsiness regime?
Well, we were interested in what are the facial signals of drowsiness. Everyone assumes that, yes, yeah, exactly. Well, if your head nods and your eyes are closed, you're asleep, okay? So that's good. And it's been known for a long time that when blink rate increases, that increased blink rate tends to be associated with drowsiness. Right. And everybody knows that yawning is associated with drowsiness. But to what degree is yawning associated with drowsiness? So when we actually did the experiment and we had subjects come in and fall asleep at the simulation wheel, we found that people yawned early on in the driving process, so maybe 20 minutes or so before they crashed. But in the critical 1 minute period prior to a crash, they didn't yawn. So yawning was a good indicator of an overall level of fatigue, but it was not an indicator that that person was 60 seconds away from a disaster. Hmm. So it seems that yawning actually decreased. Perhaps the motor system was beginning to shut down a little bit related to the sleep, I don't know. But yawning decreased. But also very little was known about other facial movements that may be associated with drowsiness. And we found, for example, that right before people fall asleep, another thing they do is they raise their eyebrows. So
they're trying
to keep their eyes open. And they can't keep their eyelids open, but if they raise their eyebrows, they can a little bit. And then we also looked at head motion. And because, again, people have been focusing on the movement in the pitch direction associated with drowsiness, but we actually found that there's a strong signal in the roll direction. What happens is that when people are driving and becoming drowsy and they're steering, when they're alert, their upper body stays still and their distal movements work independently. When they become drowsy, it seems to all just go by the core muscles and they start to roll with the steering. So that roll signal picks way up. So that was another new piece of information. And so that was one of the ways that we're using the automated measurement system to get new information about nonverbal behavior that is applicable or useful in other fields.
Yeah, because we did we've done some programs on sleep, waking up to sleep, and talked to sleep researchers, mm-hmm. David Dinges and so on, mm-hmm. about many of these issues. Mm-hmm. And it does sound as though, how intrusive this would be, I don't know, but it does sound as though, certainly for long-distance truck drivers, mm-hmm. Having some sort of fairly simple, fairly cheap device that was monitoring sure. something that gave you an alert that said, you know.
Yeah, that this might not be okay, that you'd better, exactly.
So what about the other issues that you're dealing with here? What's a computer expression recognition toolbox?
Okay, so the computer expression recognition toolbox was what I was talking about at the very early part of the interview. So, but that is the computer vision system for automatically measuring facial movements. And so it measures basic emotions such as happy, sad, or surprised. But it also measures individual facial muscle movements. And these are individual movements from Paul Ekman's facial action coding system so that we can get a comprehensive description of what moved on the face, of what is actually in a facial display. And it's objective in that it does not attempt to say, well, this is contempt or that is anger. It just says, well, this moved and this is how much. And so that is the tool.
Is this the one that you were demonstrating at the INC?
Yes, that's what I'm demonstrating at these demonstrations.
Now, what do you do with that? Where does that go? I mean, what's the utility?
Well, the computer expression recognition toolbox is the tool that we've been using in these studies that I was describing. It's the tool that we've been using.
So it's your fundamental facial alphabet, as it were.
Exactly. It's our alphabet or our set of facial phonemes or whatever, if you believe in phonemes. And so that's what we're using to measure the face for all of these studies. That's the tool that we're using for developing the automated adaptive tutoring systems. It is the tool. It's the computer vision tool that we are using for the driver fatigue, and it's machine learning based.
Now, has anything changed since Paul started doing all this stuff a long time ago? Has it evolved or?
Anything changed with respect to the
in terms of our
understanding of facial behavior or in terms of the automated system? The automated system's changed a lot.
Has he tweaked or have you and other researchers tweaked any of the letters in the alphabet, as it were, the glossary, has it changed slightly?
Oh, the facial action glossary. Yeah. The facial action glossary has only been tweaked a little bit. You know, people were arguing about.
So a smile is still a smile.
A smile is still a smile, but you know, this movement here in the corrugator region, is that one action or is that two? Because it's actually three different muscles. So that, you know, those kinds of things. But for the most part, it's stayed very consistent. What has been updated is more information about how different constellations of facial movements map onto different emotional states or cognitive states. And that simply required more research. It required more studies to be published about, you know, when babies have their arm restrained, this is what their face does. Or in under certain conditions, what do people's faces do? And as more studies get published where they objectively measure the face, there's more information about how different facial displays may be associated with different emotions or different states. Now, that's not completely agreed upon in science. There are people with different views about what facial expressions mean, what they're associated with, or even how many dimensions there really are of emotion and of facial displays.
But if you're navigating through social space, mm-hmm. which is what moving organisms do to make a living, and you are deficient or less skilled than others mm-hmm. at being able to read the impact of your trajectory, mm-hmm. I would have thought that might be a handicap. So, I mean, if you look at the, I assume that the one of the primary problems in the spectrum of disorders that get loosely called autism mm-hmm. is that reading those facial expressions, figuring out somebody's status in a system and so on, those are all terribly difficult. And are you doing any work in that area?
Absolutely. So being able to both read facial expressions and produce appropriate facial expressions is extremely important for navigating the social landscape. And it's an area where individuals with autism are greatly impaired. And not only that, but this kind of social navigation is the scaffolding behind which much other more structured learning takes place. And so with the social scaffolding, without the social scaffolding there, it's actually very difficult for lots of other learning to happen. So one of the major interests in our lab is to develop an intervention based on the facial expression measurement tool to give people with autism feedback on their facial expressions, give them practice producing facial expressions. And what we wonder is, after lots of practice and lots of positive feedback for making different kinds of facial displays, do the facial expressions change? Do the facial expressions, whether they're posed or spontaneous, do the facial expressions look more similar to typical children or typical adults? Does the timing of facial expressions change? And conversely, does it have an effect on the perception of facial expressions? Are you better at recognizing facial expressions if you have lots of practice producing and copying facial expressions? Because there seems to be a fair amount of evidence for an association between perception and production, that the perceptual system may be strongly linked to the motor production system. So if you see a facial expression and then produce the facial expression, are you better then at subsequently recognizing the facial expression later?
All right, so let me try and unpack this a little bit further, because it gets confusing for me anyway.
Okay.
You can certainly pick up papers that would say that maybe the underlying problem in autism, in inability to read facial expressions and so on, is an impaired mirror neuron system.
There is a theory about that, sure.
I'm not quite sure exactly what an impaired mirror neuron system implies, what it constitutes, whether we're talking about a failure to build appropriate neural networks or whatever. I don't know what exactly it means. Do you have any insights there?
Okay, so I don't know what exactly that means either. in the sense that I don't think that there's a simple answer as to the impairment in autism is this or it's that. It seems that there's a very complex neural basis behind autism. But certainly there's a lot of evidence in autism that that the tendency to mimic and imitate is somehow different or impaired, and that has profound impacts on many other aspects of behavior and on learning and in life. And there's some evidence for that at several different levels. And what we're hoping with this intervention is that is to give them direct practice with mirroring nonverbal behavior. I want them to see an expression and mirror it and get lots of practice with that, and to see if deliberate intervention with this kind of mirroring carries over later into their both their own productions and their own ability to perceive. And there's a comment I want to make on that in terms of facial expression understanding, and that is that with typical individuals, when we make a facial expression, that motor movement seems to be associated with autonomic activity related to that emotion, and also influences self-reportive mood, that you tend to feel that emotion in your self-reports, or when asked certain questions, or how you feel about certain things, or whether you say a neutral Chinese character is a happy character or a sad character is influenced by whether you may have bitten a pen with a smile movement or bitten a pen with an angry movement. So given that there's an association between a facial movement and the a visceral sensation of that emotion, then practice mirroring a facial expression could actually influence your ability to understand another person's emotions, because you see it and then actually feel it yourself.
What do you think is going on when that happens, though? I mean, in terms of neurons, neuronal activity. Do you think you're building new networks or revitalizing ones that have fallen dormant? I mean, I'm just using very loose phrases here, but
I think it's enabling learning. It's enabling associations to take place. So you have the perceptual input of the facial expression. Then you have the motor production of the facial expression to match it. You have the associated, now again, this is in typical individuals, and we need to investigate the degree to which this happens in autism. But you have the autonomic response to making that facial expression, and the mood, a related response to making that facial expression. So you have all these things happening in close succession, so there's an ability to learn, and also an ability to bootstrap, and in particular an ability to bootstrap between a deliberate facial expression production system and the spontaneous subcortical system that I made reference to earlier. The idea being that you make the expression, and then now you have the autonomic activity associated with that emotion and the sensation of that motion, and that kickstarts the spontaneous expression system, so that you now have engaged the spontaneous expression system in this process.
Oh, one of the other things that in that book a colleague and I did some years ago called The Origin of Mind, we talked about the importance of a repetition effect. One of the things that again enables you to appropriately and optimally navigate social spaces to be able to figure out where people are in this landscape. And that's impaired. There was a commentary by Chris and Uta Frith on this whole notion of reputation effect being severely handicapped in autistic syndromes as well. So that would be part of the same kind of thing, I think.
Yes. And also this discussion isn't limited to autism. There's actually even ADHD, people with ADHD have some issues on navigating social landscapes and social interaction. And one commonality between the two may be a timing issue, that the response to the nonverbal behavior may be slowed in ADHD and may also be slowed in autism. I'm not saying that these are related in any other way. I don't think they're related at all, but except that that the timing of processing of the nonverbal behavior may be implicated in both of them and needs to be investigated. So for example, with autism, several years ago, a study came out by one of our colleagues here at UCSD showing that individuals with autism don't spontaneously mimic facial expressions. So you show a typical college student a facial expression, you put EMG on their face, and you can detect some motor movement mimicking that expression. You show the same face to children with autism. Even though they can deliberately make the face, they don't do the spontaneous mimicry. Well, it turns out that's not true, because the same group did a follow-on study and found that they actually do mimic the expression, they just do it slower, that there's a difference in their dynamics. In fact, even it appears that the peak magnitude of the mimicry seems to be similar, but there's a big response delay, that the children with autism do this much more slowly. So there may be a timing issue. There seems to be a timing issue in their spontaneous mimicry. There may be a timing issue in their perception of the expression. And so that might be part of what's going on with the social dysfunction. And I really emphasize part of, because I don't.
So this work that you're doing along with, I see Jim Tanaka's involved in this as well. Is a recalibration part of the story? In other words, shifting the timing.
Yes, a speed up. Yeah, exactly. Increasing the increasing the speed. Yes.
Right. So, how did you get into this business in the first place? I'm just curious. Why did you go into science? What was the whole? Oh. Did you have parents with a science background, or a
I do have
great
parents.
Teacher?
Yes, I do have parents with a science background. So when I was in college, after deciding that I wasn't going to be a lawyer, I was majoring in English creative writing at Middlebury College, which is in Vermont. For anybody who's from the Northeast knows. And it was actually my father, who is an MD, kept saying, "What are you going to do with your math skills? You're good at math." And the funny thing is, it took me forever to realize I was good at math. I'm like, "No, I'm not good at math. No, I don't like math." Even though I would always sit down and do my math homework first when I was in junior high school. In high school, I'd turn on the music and do math for 2 hours. But I don't like math because girls don't, right? So that was one of the issues going on. So by the time I was a sophomore in college, my dad finally convinced me that I liked it and that I was good at it. So I switched to a math major. And then after that, I was really interested in I was interested in visual processing and in the crossover between computational theory, computational issues, and how that can help us understand visual processing. So when I graduated, I got interested in computational vision. I went and got an RA position at MIT with Jeremy Wolf, who doesn't do computational work directly, but does some really. I was a research assistant with Jeremy Wolf. Yeah, so he's not a computational vision person directly, but does some really fascinating psychophysics on visual perception. So I worked with him for a year at MIT on visual psychophysics.
And you have some very early papers, I noticed, with Ramachandran.
Yes,
so that
on
would be
plasticity. Right. Yes, yes. So actually, when I started graduate school here at UCSD, I was talking to Rama, and he said, "I've got this great idea to." This is Rama who's saying this, of course. that I've got this great idea to look at sensory plasticity in people who have had limb amputations, because the paper by Pons had just come out showing in monkey how the sensory maps shift following amputation of a limb in monkey. There's a whole series of papers, but this whole literature on plasticity, and particularly plasticity in adult animals, was extremely new and extremely groundbreaking. And so he had the idea to look at patients who'd had an amputation to see if the phantom limb sensations might possibly be associated with the shift in, with the plasticity and the shift in the sensory maps in the brain. And so that's in fact what my first year project was with Rama. And he ended up, we both ended up publishing it in Science. And that was a very fun project. But I will also never forget being a first year student, getting ready to give my first year presentation, and Rama was encouraging me to stand up in front of the department and say, "I'm going to refute three dogmas of neuroscience." And as a first year graduate student, I opted not to say that. But he gave a talk on this, I saw him give a talk on it a few months later, and he sure enough, he stood up and he had a slide that said that, and he pulled it off, or at least from my perspective, he did. So
it's nice that he at least offered you the opportunity to do that.
What's that?
It's nice that he offered you the opportunity.
That's right. That's right. And I really learned a lot about how to sell a project, how to write it up and make it interesting. Because of course he was actually in India when I was writing up my first year project. So I was sitting there at the computer with, you know, with doing all my statistical analysis, which of course you need to do in it. And I had this sort of very, very cut and dry kind of, this is what we did, this was our methods, and these are results, and it's significant here, and so on and so forth. And then he turned around and wrote the paper for Science. And just, he's like, no, this is how you write up, you know, this is how you present something to make it interesting. And honestly, you need a bit of both. But it was just great to see, to try writing it myself and then watch how he did it and see how it was different and learn from that. Mm. So that was good.
So it's interesting that you began with it. I mean, this was the very beginning of Rama doing the Phantom Limb stuff.
Yes.
Which, curiously enough, ironically, emerged from a scandal about mistreatment of monkeys, if you remember, the Ed Taub and Pons stuff, but led to some rather interesting data.
Yes, exactly.
Ironically. And now here we have...
And it's actually, and this ironically, that this really tragic mistreatment of the animals may in fact end up benefiting people who are suffering from phantom limb pain. Yeah. So something good may be coming of it.
Yeah, yeah. And now of course Rama is very, very much an advocate of the importance of mirror neurons. So there's a parallel
yes.
trajectory here as well. So, why did you decide to go into machine perception, I mean, in the perception story and the work with Javier and the robotics?
Well, as I said, I was always interested in computational vision,
right.
And computer vision. So when I came here for graduate school, I really wanted to move in the direction of machine learning theory. And at that time, people used the word neural network learning more often. So I really wanted to learn about that and learn about how to apply those kinds, how to learn about biological vision and computational principles of biological vision and try to find how that might inform computer vision and vice versa, or how information from computer science might inform our understanding of biological vision. I was always very interested in that, but it took a lot of groundwork to be really ready to do some of that research. But I started working on that with Terry Sanofsky. So he was my graduate advisor,
right.
And we were working on basically computational learning algorithms and how those apply to computer vision and recognizing faces and facial expressions by computer, and how those kinds of principles applied can help us understand face perception in humans. And in particular, so things that were going on in Terry's lab at the time were focused very much on information theory, information maximization. That was right at the time when Tony and Terry were writing their paper on independent component analysis, and that paper was focused very much on information theory and information maximization. So I started looking at independent component analysis and ideas of information maximization and how the information maximization kinds of principles could help us understand face processing in the kinds of phenomena that are reported in experimental psychology, such as the other race effect and things like that. So that's where that direction went.
You know, I ask this question all the time of women in science, whether it's made a difference, whether they found it difficult, or whether I should just retire the question because it's gone away. And it,
yeah.
Without, well, what would your answer be? They've all said no, don't retire the question.
I definitely say don't retire the question, but I do think a lot of things have changed hugely and changed in a really positive direction. One thing that I noticed as a graduate student was joining Terry's lab and being in a very computational lab, a computational neuroscience kind of lab, there were I was often the only woman in the lab, and it was a big lab. You know, there were probably 20 or so students, mostly postdocs. So I was junior and the only woman. On occasion, there would be others, and later on, there was another graduate student, which was good. But it was strange to walk into an environment where you're the only one. The atmosphere in that lab was just very, I used to joke and call it the testosterone lab. Yeah. And in some ways it was good and the energy level was high. But in some ways there was very, it was just a different kind of experience. And particularly going to NIPS and giving my first conference talk to a computational audience at NIPS, 500 people in the audience, and I was the only woman to actually talk at that conference, except for an invited talk by Liz Bates before me, and thank God, because I was so glad she was there, because I was finding this hard.
Yeah.
NIPS has gone from 3 women out of 500 at the conference to, you know, maybe 20% women. I mean, it's still more men, but the difference is just palpable. It just feels different in the sense of feeling comfortable, not just feeling like I stick out like a sore thumb and I'm dominated by, you know, so that's really nice. I mean, simply going from 3 out of 500 to something, you know, even if it's 5%, it makes a very palpable difference in terms of feeling comfortable.
When you were telling your own story there about your father's pressure and pointing out that you were good at math, and you actually said, no, women don't do math right. I mean, that's...
I never articulated that, but that was...
Danica McKellar goes around doing books for young women these days. And computational neurobiology, I mean, a lot of that's, certainly computational neuroscience, a lot of that is math.
Yeah.
So, but things are changing.
Yes.
What would your advice be now then? There's a little book by Sir Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist. There's also that book by Ramoni Cajal, Advice to a Young Investigator.
All right.
What would your advice now be to a young scientist, somebody coming into this field?
Well, the advice that I usually give to people coming into the field is to really look around and find somebody who is working on something that really excites you, and go to that lab and volunteer in that lab if you need to, but go and start working in that lab. And I mean, it's very simple and very straightforward and basic, but a lot of people don't take that level of initiative, which is surprising. And wait for a position to be posted or an opportunity to be listed. And you need to really forge the path that you want and go after what interests you the most. Mm. And then go after it hard. And that's what I would advise.
Do you ever think of doing, you were at Middlebury, you were doing writing, right? Creative writing. So, I mean, did you ever consider another career?
Well, I have a book, right? And hopefully it's not completely creative.
You mean completely uncreative?
Well, okay, yeah. Creative, but not made up. No, I think once I got into science, I realized that I liked it. And I you know, it's funny, because it kept being a surprise, because it wasn't what I was supposed to like.
What is it about science that you like, and what, more importantly, what do you think as the president said it in his inaugural address, he will restore science to its rightful place. What do you think is the rightful place of science in this society?
What do I think is the rightful place of science in this society? Well, I think that science really needs to guide a lot of our decision making, and I'm always shocked to the degree that it doesn't. Science needs to guide scientific experimentation, and development needs to guide what we do in the schools. And in terms of making decisions in government and policy, we need to collect good scientific data and make the decisions based on those results. And it's incredible to me the degree to which science can be dissed by opinion. And once you get out of the science field and into politics, you don't really need data. you don't really need an experiment that's well designed. You just need persuasive oration. And so I think that science really needs to drive a lot more of the decision making, a lot of more of the policy development than it does.
Yeah, the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan is reputed to have said that everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts.
Yes, I think that's extremely well said.
The ethos of science, the history of science, and so on, does that interest you? I mean, suppose I gave you a time travel token.
Yeah.
And you could have anybody to dinner. Uh-huh. Just pump them, figure out what you want. It doesn't have to be a scientist, but who are the people that you would like to have had a chance to sit down and talk to, ask questions of?
If it doesn't have to be a scientist, I'll tell you my immediate answer to that question. I would really like to talk to Sacagawea. I want to talk to her, and
wow.
I want to ask her, how was that for you? I want to know how she ended up being the guide to this expedition just a couple of months or less after having a baby, why she ended up in that position, what she thought of being that position. Did she feel a little bit held captive by this situation? And did she effectively escape from this at one point? And how did that go for her afterwards?
So. Now, that is the most unusual answer I've certainly had so far. I mean, why is that so intriguing to you?
I think my 10-year-old son was, of course, studying history, and we came across Sacagawea, and I was looking at the situation, and it just, at one point, it struck me as very strange, and I really wondered how difficult that whole situation was for a young woman who has just had a baby, and I wondered why she was selected to this. In our own European bent history, historical account of the whole expedition, she's in this role of honor as a navigator, but I don't know why she would know where anything was once you got more than 20 miles away from where she lived. Whether she was in fact in more of a position of being stuck in a very difficult situation. I wondered if the tribal chief was thinking, well, you know, here are these people pressuring me to give them someone, and you know, I can't give them X, Y, or Z because we really need them here. But here's this woman who's just had a baby, and so she can't work for a while. So go take Sacagawea, and here she's got to deal with this situation with a very young baby. I mean, you've got kids, right? The last place that I would want to be is in a canoe halfway across the country in the wilderness, trying to figure out, you know, how to get my baby to go to sleep. Anyway.
All right. Now, who would you add as a scientist then to
right.
your dinner party?
So, that's a tough one. I think I'd really like to have perhaps I didn't realize this was going to be so gender specific, but I'd like to hear from some of the earlier female scientists, such as Lisa Meitner or even Marie Curie, just to see what it was like for them in science when they were working. So yeah.
It does seem to be a little theme
very,
here.
Very gender specific theme, which I hadn't really expected, but it would be a very interesting conversation between all of us, including Sacagawea.
I just came back from a trip to England at the Royal Society, and while they were there, they were having a celebration for the centennial of mm-hmm. Dorothy Hodgkin, mm-hmm. who obviously a very famous mm-hmm. female scientist. And there was a little book had been produced by somebody involved in a scheme there, a fellowship, and it listed, I think it was 64, I don't remember exactly how many, women scientists and told you about their trajectories, current ones. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it still strikes me that this kind of effort has to go into recognition of what's going on there. It's still obviously an issue. Hopefully getting better.
Hopefully. Oh, yeah. I think probably much better. Yes.
Where do you hope that this will go in a few years' time? What's your
is in the facial expression research direction.
Yeah.
Right. So, well, I really hope that in a few years' time we have an automated tutoring system that gets real-time feedback from body posture and from facial expression and is able to use that information to adapt the system in an effective way. And I hope that we have intervention games for kids with autism that are engaging and reinforcing to this population so that they want to spend time with them, want to interact with the characters that we develop, and have games that where not only does the child mimic the character, but the character mimics the child, so that there's some exchange going on, so mm-hmm. that we can maybe get some transfer. We can learn about social back and forth that we can then start to transfer to more realistic images and more realistic social situations. And so I hope to have interventions like that. And then I hope to understand better both facial expression production in autism and facial expression perception in autism and how those may be linked and whether we can, and whether there's plasticity in that system, whether we can change that, whether we can see differences in fMRI before and after practice with production.
How general do you see the application of these sorts of things? I mean, we were talking in a panel this morning about how the confluence of knowing more about brain, knowing more about the plasticity of the brain, and the development of technologies that can take advantage of and help in implementing mm-hmm. some of the new research, how that could possibly be a very useful wedge, a tool for improving the science of educating, the science of learning globally, possibly. Is
certainly
that too ambitious? Or
I think it's the right direction. It's very ambitious, but it's the right direction. Certainly, information that we have about learning and plasticity can impact how we teach language, and that's certainly something that Paula Talal has been exploring. But just understanding how to develop the ability of our neurons in the auditory system to discriminate sound, perhaps by exaggerating the differences in the sound, and then slowly making that sound signal more typical, more similar to actual speech. I think the same kind of thing could be done in the visual dimension and with facial expression, for example, and with faces in general. And these are ideas that are related to some of the computational principles that I talked about earlier, information maximization. So these kinds of computational principles, understanding of plasticity, I think could really help us develop some programs and some interventions to really change the way change the way we're able to help children learn, yeah. or to get them ready to move on to the next stage.
Yeah, I notice again that one of the that this is one of the fields where you find a lot more women, by the way, because in sort of child development.
Oh, development. Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Neuroscience of language, all those sorts of things.
Sure.
And also more collaborative enterprises. The
yes.
Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center is well known for the network of network
yes.
structure that we have,
yes.
A kind of silo destruction ethos, in other words,
yes.
trying to build bridges between all these various disciplines. That's probably very simpatico for you, isn't it? I mean, the collaborative nature of all of this.
I really enjoy the collaborative nature. I really enjoy the collaborative nature of the center. So that's something that really works for me and draws me in. I don't know if that's something that interests the female scientists more, but that's, I think, a real strength of the center.
Maybe that's where the Sacagawea stuff comes from.
Yes.
You know, I mean, instead of Lewis and Clark asking if she'd kindly like to go along.
Right, exactly.
as they forged across the continent.
Yeah.
All right. So, male and female scientists as collaborative traveling companions on this enterprise to fix all our problems. What are you optimistic about? Yeah. Good. Well, we'll keep track of it. Marnie, thanks very much.